Jimmy, you're a man of class. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's get the intro right. Going, and we will be right back. Right back.
With your hosts, Wayne New, Greg Donald,
and Lou Mavs. All right, welcome to Rat Salary View. Today, we are joined by our usual Lou Mavs and Manny. And our new friend here, Tony, he joins me on the Almost Human Live podcast. But we are also joined by a special guest, Jimmy Waldo from the band Alcatraz, Black Thorn, and so many other bands. Welcome to the show, Jimmy.
I'm glad to be there, Wayne.
Thanks for coming on.
It's all good. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, no problem. Actually, the reason why we had you on is because last week we had Steve Rosen on. And I guess you're very good friends with Steve Rosen, right?
One of my best friends for 40 years. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And you actually, you worked on music because he was talking about some album that he put together, and you worked on an album with him?
Yeah. Steven and I have been writing songs together for ever since we met. And, you know, hustling, trying to get stuff placed and without much luck. And we put out a record a few years ago, which was all our demos. And all these different people, Jeff Scott Soto sang on a couple of songs, and Rowan Robertson from Dio's band played guitar on stuff, and a lot of different really cool people. And so there was a label in Australia that wanted to just put out all those demos. So we did. Then my manager, Giles Lavery, loved the songs, came up with the idea, said, why don't you guys do a real record? So Steven and I started writing again. And this is during COVID. And I went back to LA and stayed with him for a couple of weeks. And we rewrote some older stuff we had and rearranged it. And Stephen got the idea, well, why don't we get some of my friends, his guitar player friends, Joe Satriani and people like that. So, and I called on a few favors, and we got all these really amazing guitar players to play on this record that we did. So, yeah, it was fun. We were really lucky. All these guys were great.
Yeah, anyone's interested, the album's called Highway Sentinels. It's available on all streaming media platforms.
Yeah, right. Highway Sentinels?
Highway
Sentinels. Cool.
That one of the things you don't have, Tony?
Don't have it.
Don't have it.
Just hearing about it. Sucked.
Well, now you know.
Well, now he'll have it. October is the I believe the 40th year of the Alcatraz No Parole for Rock and Roll. Am I correct?
Yes. Cool.
Yeah. Right here, man.
Wow.
One of my favorite debut albums of all time and one of my top 10 favorite albums ever.
Man,
great album.
I really appreciate that. I really do. Because I love the record. And that was a good band. It was a really good band back then. And too bad it couldn't have done another couple of records anyway, just in that form.
Well, I think the issue was that you had Yngwie Malmsteen in the band, who I love as a musician, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, we do appreciate him.
Yeah.
Amazing. There's nobody, yeah, ice cream film. Nobody that does that. I mean, Yngwie... He's a one of a kind.
Jimmy, I gotta ask you like a little background on that. So did you and Graham kind of form the band first and you brought in Yngwie?
Well, Gary Shea and I started the band with Graham, and we auditioned guitar players, and so we had auditioned a few guys that were just not happening at all, and. Somebody said, hey, there's this new kid in town, this Swedish guy, plays in this band called Steeler. I never heard of Steeler. I didn't know who they were, but he said, okay, we'll have him come down. So he came down, and we played, and It was great. It was a good, really good fit. You know, Yngwie was way into the rainbow thing, obviously, and Graham was, and we were kind of using that as a launch pad. We had to start somewhere. We didn't have all the songs written at that point. So we were doing rainbow songs and a couple of songs that I'd written and Graham had written. But Yngwie just was a perfect fit. And he was this crazy young kid that just a lot of fire and a lot of, he played with a lot of aggression. And I love that in guitar players. I don't like the real polished, you know, perfect. I like the aggressive thing. So Yngwie was that and then some.
Sure was, yeah.
That's the way he was, sure. You know, and on the road, and it was great.
Did he contribute at all, and what went into the second album for Disturbing the Peace, or did you guys just kind of start from scratch with that one?
Oh, no.
Second album, Disturbing the Peace.
He was long gone by then, and
were you looking to get another flashy guitar player? Is that how you came about to get Steve Vai?
Well, you know, not really, to be honest. I had talked to a lot of guys, and I won't mention any names, but some of them didn't even want the gig because they didn't want to do the Yngwie thing. And they could. These guys had chops. But and I tried to explain, we don't want to do the Yngwie thing. I didn't see any point in doing that. So anyway, I got in touch with David Rosenthal, a keyboard player from Billy Joel's band.
Yeah.
And we were friends, and I was calling everybody, just looking for players. And I called David, and David says, I have a phone number for you. Don't call anybody else. This is the guy. And it was Steve. So I called him, and that was that. You know, I wouldn't let him go. I mean, he wasn't sure either whether he wanted to do it or not, because he said, I don't play like that. And I just don't want you to play like that. You know, for better or for worse, we didn't want that. We took a different direction, you know.
Yeah.
And
he did a great job. I mean, it's a great album. You know, that's what put Steve Vai on the map for me, because I wasn't familiar with him from Zappa. I remember seeing the God Bless video when it came out. And then right around the same time, he was playing Jack Butler in the Crossroads movie, you know, Save the Forest, you know. And so it was like, wow, this dude's killer, you know. And then from there, it was like, next thing you know, he's in David Lee Roth's band, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were getting ready to tour with Steve. We played our last show in L.A. And then after the gig, we were getting ready to get on the Winnebago. And Steve says, hey, Jimmy, can we talk for a minute? And he came over and told me, he says, man, sorry, but I got the gig with David Lee Roth. And I shook his hand. I said, man, good for you. That's great. You know, sorry to see you go. But so we did the tour, and then he came back, and then we were recording. Steve's got a little, at the time, had a little garage studio thing where we rehearsed and recorded demos. And so we kept recording there and rehearsing there, and auditioned some guitar players, and Steve was coming and going. We were at his house, so no bad vibes at all. And we wrote a couple of more songs. Steve had written a thing, and which we recorded, but Yngwie was long gone by then. He had started doing his thing, and, you know, so he didn't have anything to do with that record.
Was the Japanese concert that was filmed with Steve, was that filmed before he announced that he was leaving for David Lee Roth's band?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. That was incredible footage. I mean, I've watched both concerts. They are available on YouTube. And, you know, just watching them made me remember why I fell in love with the band in the first place. And this is going to take you for a time warp. Okay. My first exposure to Alcatraz, do you remember a television show called The Rock Palace?
Yes.
Yes. So hosted by Howie Mandel.
Yes.
And Alcatraz were on the same episode as Dio's band, the original lineup. This was the Holy Diver Tour.
Right.
So this was my first exposure to Alcatraz. And the first song that they showed from them, they played three songs. First one was Too Young to Die, Too Drunk to Live.
Right, right.
Second one was Hiroshima Mon Amour, and the third one was Island in the Sun.
Right.
And I was 4 years old.
Yeah.
It made such an impact on me. And my brother had the cassette, and I was like, put it on, put it on. You know, me as an annoying 4 year old, no different than me as an annoying 42 year old, but I digress.
That's incredible.
That's crazy, man.
What a story like that. I mean, that was a pretty interesting show. That was a new thing they were trying to do, the Palace in LA. And, yeah. Palace Theater, really cool venue. We were supposed to play there in November, but the government shutdown thing screwed up the visas and passports. And three of our guys are UK guys, so we couldn't get them over here. And a girls' school, and they couldn't come, so we had to cancel. But we were supposed to play at the Palace where we did that.
It's still there?
Yeah.
The venue's still there?
Yeah, so we were supposed to play
there. Was that the same place that was Perkins Place at one time?
No, Perkins Palace was in Pasadena.
Okay. Yeah, I went to the one that's in LA. I went there in like 97, one of the Foundation's forums.
Right. Yeah, the Foundation's forum was in Burbank, but
yeah. I saw a show there one night. It was Raven and Quiet Riot and the Loudness Guys had a new band called Sly, but that was like 1997. So,
yeah, I played that convention with Blackthorn.
Yeah, that's something else we wanted to ask you about was Blackthorn. So basically, yeah. After Alcatraz, well, you did one more album. You did the album with Danny Johnson, which I've got here. Yes. Which is a more streamlined album. It's got some great songs on it. I love the Animals cover that was on it. But it's got some really good songs on it. But it's definitely more commercial, more streamlined, straightforward.
It's just, I could not find a guitar player. I mean, I looked, I talked to so many guys. And the few guys that I found that wanted to do it were too young. And it would have been a nightmare. They didn't get it about the song. Well, they weren't songwriters. We needed a writer. So that record was not our finest hour. That's for sure. It was tough.
Danny came in at the last minute, maybe.
Well, he didn't come in at the last minute, but he kind of, it wasn't a good fit for Danny. And I'd been friends for a long time, and I just thought he would rise to the occasion. But that was not a good call on my part or Danny's part. He's not that kind of player. And we needed to stick with what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And Graham wanted to do other stuff. And Danny just writes the way he writes. And so we got off track, in my opinion. There's some good songs on there, but doing covers and all this other stuff. It was just, you know, it was what it was. But we had a lot of great writers that wanted to write for us. And Graham wouldn't do it. Graham wouldn't do the songs, the outside material. So
I'm surprised he did the Animals cover.
Yeah, well, he loved that song. So
okay, yeah.
He liked it. It was okay. You know, but I knew some of these guys, these other writers, Holly Knight, who had written with Aerosmith, and Dwayne Hitchings, who had written with Heart and everybody else. Capitol Records was so excited because we had all these writers that we were friends with. And these guys were just like, and people were just like, cool, we'll write for you guys. And Don Grierson at Capitol was just over the moon. He just thought, this is it. We're going to launch this thing. And Graham wouldn't do any of it. So
I got to ask you too. We were talking about before we went on air. I think Manny had brought up. So the first album, the press that I have is from Japan. It's like an RCA, but in the U.S. you were on Rockshire Records.
Yes.
And that label, it seems like I remember reading something. Maybe Yngwie or someone said that the label like went under, and they were putting you guys up at a house, and basically it was mafia or something's connected to it or something. Or...
Yeah. Rocky and Shirley, Rockshire, the people there, Shirley.
The name sound questionable.
they were the nicest people, the coolest people. Everybody at that label that he hired were just fantastic. But anyway, Shirley worked for Howard Hughes, for the Hughes Corporation. She worked in the medical payments. They had their own health insurance. So Shirley was in charge of all that financially. And her husband, Rocky, Shirley just started writing him checks, Dr. Rocky Davis. Millions and millions of dollars. Nobody knows. We heard 13, 14, 15 million. I don't know.
Wow.
I'll tell you this. They were throwing money at us to anything we needed. I mean, they had a whole complex. They had amazing rehearsal facility, beautiful recording studio, and the record company was there as well. So, but they just, Rocky walked around with 10 grand in his pocket. I mean, he was an ex-biker. You know, he'd been to prison. So, but they were cool people. They were really nice people. And they killed for us. They did, they hired the best people and we toured our ass off. You know, it was great. But then the IRS caught up with them.
Oh, jeez.
And they got busted. So, and we slipped away.
That's good that you were able to retain a record deal from Capitol for the next album.
We got lucky. It was really lucky because when the IRS came in and busted them, they took all the assets. And they could have held us to a contract and said, you're one of them. Mm-hmm. And we got a release from the president of the label. He knew what was going to happen. And he let us go so that we'd be free to go do other things. A lot of the bands didn't make it. And our masters got taken by the IRS, but I don't know whatever happened to those. We've tried to track them down, can't find them.
Area 51.
Hey, yeah, 24 tracks. But yeah, so we were lucky. So we had a deal on Capitol in a matter of weeks. We were very, very lucky.
That's good. Yeah,
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your history as a musician. I don't know if New England was the first thing you ever recorded, but I do know that New England is so different from what Alcatraz is sound-wise, sonically, image-wise. There it is. Also, I saw New England was produced by Paul Stanley, or co-produced. I don't know how much he had to do with it and didn't have to do with it. But, you know, like New England was... I hate the term ARO, but that's all I can think of.
AOR, right? Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. But how did you go from ARO to what the time?
AOR.
Alcatraz was just pretty damn, for its time, pretty heavy. Nobody was playing like Yngwie at the time. And Graham Bonnet, who, by the way, is one of my favorite singers, and even now it's 74. No, he's 76. That guy can still belt it. I mean, it's incredible, but
I have no.
And even Graham, yeah, and even Graham Bonnet has a different background. He was a pop singer with the Marbles in the '60s. Yeah. So how did you, both of you, man, come into this musical transformation from what you were doing before to Alcatraz?
Well, I was always into heavy music, or what was considered at the time heavy music. I was really into the Who and Zeppelin, and those two bands, just those two bands, wrote the book. And then I got into Black Sabbath. I was into heavier stuff. So New England, we did what we did, but I was into other things, you know, okay, while that was going on. So when that band broke up, I moved to LA immediately and started working with Vincent. And even though that was not real heavy at the time, I still wanted to be in a heavier band. I still loved heavier keyboard players, heavier music. So Alcatraz for me was a real natural progression for me because that's what I wanted to do for a long time.
How did Paul Stanley come into picture?
New England was managed by Bill O'Coin, who managed this. And so we toured with Kiss, but before we toured, I'll back up. So Bill was managing the band. We had several record deals on the table, and the songs were done. The labels loved the songs the way they were. They didn't want anybody to upset the apple cart. So Paul wanted to produce. So Paul came down and we rehearsed and hung out with him. Great guy. And he had some really good ideas. And so it worked. Mike Stone as an engineer from Queen and Paul. And it just worked. You know, Paul was great. We had a really good time in the studio with him. He had some great ideas. And thank God, and God bless him for this, as he said, you shouldn't change the band. Don't chase what's on the radio. Stay true to what we're doing. Because we were influenced as the band, we did demos, and then we're getting ready to go record, and we're hearing all this other stuff on the radio, and we're thinking, you know, man, that's, look at that. They have hits. Maybe we should, you know. And Paul was really adamant about, you know, which if you think about it, that's what Kiss did for years. Kiss stayed their ground and did what they do. And they were very successful at it. So anyway, Paul had a lot to do with that, and was great in the studio, good taskmaster in the studio, keeping us, you know, working.
What was it like working with Vinnie Vincent? I mean, the way he is now, he's just kind of all over the place a little bit. But what was it like back then?
I thought the guy was amazing. We needed a guitar player to replace John Fannin in New England. But we needed a writing, singing guitar player. Mm. So I called Gene Simmons and asked Gene, and I were friends. And I just called him and I said, hey, we need a guitar player. And Gene says, I got the guy. So Gene gave me Vinny's number. I called Vinny. Vinny was in L.A., and he knew who we were. And he sent us, I think, 6 songs. And he goes, why don't you guys learn these songs, just the bass, drums, and keyboards, and then I'll come to Boston, and we'll rehearse those songs and see how it goes. So we learned those songs cold. Vinny walked in and we just played. It was like we'd always been together. So it worked out great. So Vinny said, well, I'm in LA. And I said, I'm out of here. I wanted out of Boston. And so we all moved to LA to work with Vinny. And he was singing and playing guitar. It was great. It was really good. And we did a demo for CBS. We had a great attorney that was a good friend and helped us and got us that deal with CBS through the demo. But Vinny wanted to be Yngwie. He had this thing about wanting to be faster than Yngwie and wanted to be that guy. What
that was before he heard of Yngwie, probably. So, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean.
You mean later on he wanted to be super fast. Yeah.
But, I mean, after I'd done Alcatraz, then Vinny came back to me and was like, well, I just helped him do some demos. He was writing. Probably, I guess, it was the Vinny Vincent Invasion or whatever that was. And Vinny says, we're doing demos at my house, just Vinny and I, drum machine, you know, stuff. And he's like, I can play faster than Yngwie. And he was playing all this stuff. And I was like, and I told him, I wasn't working with him. I had nothing. And I just said, Vinny, don't do that. That's not, you're not playing faster than Yngwie. You're playing wrong notes. And
yeah, it wasn't. Gene Simmons referred to Vinnie Vincent as Yngwie on crack, for the record. He did say that.
And Yngwie, Vinnie was such a good guitar player. He was like Jeff Beck. He had a real Beck vibe. And oh my God, he was so good. And it was just, what a shame to see him.
Excellent songwriter. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Great. I was going to ask you about this. I'm sure you know about the Warrior demo. Yep, this says it was 82, and there's songs on here. So it's you and Gary and Hurst with Vinny.
Yes.
And, I mean, there's some good stuff on here. I mean, there's the song Back on the Streets, of course, that Vinny did. Which has been covered by some other artists as well. It's one of his best songs ever.
Oh my God! Yeah,
yeah. It's got some, you know, some other stuff that ended up on the Invasion album and stuff. But
is Gypsy in Her Eyes? Is that on there?
What's that?
Yeah,
Gypsy in Her Eyes.
Yeah, Gypsy in Her Eyes is on here. Yeah, Betrayed. But yeah, Baby O Y, which I think Baby O's was on the first Vinnie Vincent album. I was going to tell you a funny story. So when Vinnie made his first appearance back a few years back, he made his first appearance at that KISS convention down in Atlanta.
Yeah.
A buddy of mine go down to it. And my buddy Larry, he is like a massive KISS fan. I'm a big KISS fan, but Larry is like religiously, right? So we buy the meet and greet thing for Vinny, which is like $50 to get a signature, right? $50 per signature. So I'm like, I'll do it. I'll get it. Just get my Vinny Vincent album signed. And Robert Fleischman was there and I got him to sign it.
Wow.
We buy the little ticket to get in line. Well, the lines is taking forever and I'm missing all the entertainment going on. So I told him, I said, man, you know, we'll come back later. So we ended up, we're the last two guys in line to get autographs because the promoter said Vinny's going to stay here until everybody gets their signature. We go in. I didn't see what Larry brought. I go in. I lay my Invasion album down. He speaks to me. He signs the records. Like, thank you. Well, Larry walks in with this, lays it out, and Vinny just like goes, oh, my God, this is a bootleg. I didn't make any money on this. And he starts going off or whatever, but he signs it anyway because Larry's paid his $50, you know. Wow. Just thought it was funny. And Larry is crushed, man. I mean, he's like, man, I didn't mean to piss him off. I didn't know it was a bootleg. And I'm just like, dude, you got a good story out of it. So I can say.
It's funny.
I need to mention, and this is all due respect to Robert Fleischman, who I'm Facebook friends with, and I think he's an incredible talent. But I thought that the Warrior demo, which is also available on streaming media, I thought that demo has the best versions of the songs that ended up becoming Vinnie Vincent Invasion songs. I mean, that version of Back on the Streets, I mean, I prefer to the ones from Three Speed, which was Attack of the Rock Aliens, that soundtrack, and by John Norum. And I think John Norum's an awesome guitarist, but there was just something about it that I don't know, just really it tugged at the heartstrings. You know, there was real emotion in the performance of it and the recording of it. I mean,
it's a great song.
I wish we had gotten to hear like an actual studio recorded label released version of it, because I think that really would have been a big hit for all of you.
And we were right there. We were doing those demos at the record plant in LA. And KISS was in the next room. And Vinny had been writing with KISS. And I know Gene and Paul. And we'd see each other, hey man, how you doing? You know, but I knew something was up. I knew Vinny was headed in that KISS direction because Gene loved his guitar playing, but his writing. Vinny was such a great writer. And I could see it like, I'm thinking Gene's got his eye on him. Even though Gene's the one that turned me on to Vinny before, I think all along Gene was thinking that he'd make a good guy in KISS, which he did. They made a couple of great records together.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I discovered Alcatraz with No Parole for Rock and Roll, obviously the first one. Because back then there was no internet, so if I read a magazine and the band sounded interesting, I'd just go buy it without hearing a note. I didn't know Yngwie Malmsteen at all. I don't even think I pronounced the name Yngwie. I think I pronounced it in Yngwie or something because I didn't know how to pronounce it. But
we all called
him listening to that. I remember listening to that album, and he just really stood out. I mean, the whole band was really good. But in retrospect, I listened to it and I go, how did they rein him in where he sounds part of a band? Because when he went solo, you know, it produced by Yngwie, you know, Yngwie plays bass, guitar. Nowadays, even singing. I mean, he's even gotten rid of his singers. And he was a young guy. I think he was, 21 when he was with you guys, Jimmy?
18 or 19, I think.
Oh, he was even younger than that.
Yeah, I think so. Something like that.
Yeah.
How
did you guys rein him in to become part of it?
We didn't rein him in. We were at rehearsal. We had this rehearsal place at Rockshire Records, big, huge room. Two Marshall stacks set up. I had a B3, two Leslies, the whole wall of gear. And we rehearsed all day, every day. And Yngwie loved to play. I mean, he would be playing, and I'd say, Yngwie, we got to rehearse, talk about this arrangement. Hey, stop. And he'd be just like wailing, you know, by himself. But the once the song started, he played the song. And those arrangements were all of us. Yngwie never said, well, in Hiroshima, I want a longer solo. I mean, if you look at it, his solos are not extremely long solos. You know, there's a lot of guitar players out there that do much longer solos than Yngwie did on that record. But that's what that's all Yngwie wanted. He didn't, nobody told him, you can't play, it's 16 bars, buddy. Nobody said that. He just played a solo and stopped, and that was it. It's like, yeah, this is good. This is okay, man. This is solo, man. Okay, cool. And we'd be playing, and you know, and that it just came out that way.
And how did you hook up with Graham Bonnet? He was, I guess, he had left Rainbow. I know he did a solo album called Line 'Em Up, and I think it was based out of England at the time. I'm not sure. How did you hook up with Graham Bonnet?
His manager knew about New England, Gary Shea and I. So he was looking for musicians to put together a band with Graham. And he got in touch with us. His son, Paul, found out about us and gave the number to his dad. His dad called us and Andy Truman, who managed Graham. And we went over and met with Graham and had a beer or five and talked. And then we went to Graham's house and worked on some songs in his garage. Just Gary and I and Graham. Graham with an acoustic guitar. And I took a keyboard over. I don't remember what it was. And just worked on some songs.
And did he want to go into the heavy rock direction? Because, I mean, he always seems like, he always says, I'm not a metal guy and stuff. He's always said that, but it seems like everything that he does is always on the heavy rock side because he sings it so well.
Well, yeah, my God, he's incredible. Yeah.
Considering the last album that he did before Alcatraz was Assault Attack from the Michael Schenker Group, which is my favorite release from that band.
Yeah,
mine as well. I agree. Yeah. Mine's as well. That's my favorite Michael Schenker album.
Graham just sort of goes with the flow. So if there was a record deal over here and there's going to be money for everybody, and but you need to sing like this, then that's what he did.
Yeah.
Because as time went along in Alcatraz, he definitely was not happy about the heavier direction. And we had to play those songs off No Parole from Rock and Roll live. And Graham didn't want to play most of those songs. So it became a problem for sure. And he just said it. He was very vocal about it. I hate this kind of music. I don't understand it. I don't want to do it. And we took,
what it was about 10 years between the last Alcatraz record and you did the Blackthorn. Was there some stuff in between that you guys did together, or did you just come together and you were just like, hey?
Graham was in Australia. Graham had moved to Australia with his wife and kids. And Bob Kulick and I we were putting together a band and looking for a singer. And I get this phone call from Australia, and it's Graham going, I got to get out of here, man. Do you have anything over there I can do? I'll do anything to get out of Australia and come back to the States. So I said, well, as a matter of fact, Bob and I are doing this. He didn't know Bob. I said, Bob and I are doing a band and blah, blah, blah. And so he borrowed some money from a friend and he came to the States. And then he stayed with me at my house for about a year. And we did the Blackthorn thing, put that together, went through a bunch of different musicians to get it together, and then did that album, had a deal with Polydor in Japan and a publishing deal with Sony in Japan. So that financed the whole thing. And we went to Japan and did press, and we played an acoustic thing. I've seen that.
That's great.
Yeah, and, but other than that, and then we played the Foundations Forum, which is funny because we got our set cut short by Yngwie. Yngwie had played before us. We were on a different stage. Yngwie had played before us. This is a funny story. And he used smoke bombs and stuff, you know. So he set off smoke bombs and stuff like he always does. And I watched it. I was like, cool. Hey, man, you're rock fucking Yngwie. You're doing it, buddy. And then we went on because the gear was all set up. So there was no changeover time. So we went on like within minutes. We got about three songs in and the sprinkler system went off and the fire alarms went off and the fire department showed up and made us quit playing. So they said, go back in the dressing room, get out of here, get out of this room. So we went back in the dressing room and we were bummed. We didn't know what was going on. And then Yngwie came running in our dressing room over to me and he goes, I am so sorry. He goes, I didn't do that on purpose. I didn't do that on purpose. And I said, I know you didn't do that on purpose. I said, that's part of your show. I mean, we'd found out by then that it set off the smoke alarm, the alarms on that shit. But he was so apologetic. And he was going on. And we were, it was all good. We talked for a long time. And then we went, he and I went to the bar after that. And that's when Yngwie used to drink. And he and I closed the bar at that point, but we had fun. But he shut us down. Everybody says, oh man, Yngwie did that on purpose. He didn't do it on purpose. It was a total fluke accident.
This is the first time hearing of it.
We're on CMC Records International in the States at that time too.
Last week, Steve Rosen said he got into an altercation with Yngwie.
Pardon?
Steve Rosen, he said he got into an altercation with Yngwie and ended up like punching him or something. Is that before or after that incident?
That was before Blackthorn. So that would have been, well, Yngwie had left Alcatraz and Ronnie Dio had a birthday. We were managed by Wendy Dio. So we're friends with Ronnie and so Ronnie had a birthday party at the Cat and Fiddle Pub in L.A., which that Cat and Fiddle was on Sunset, a pretty big pub, probably held 200 people or something. And so the birthday party was there. So Steven and I went to the birthday party. We were having a great time. It was great. I mean, I knew everybody there, and Ronnie was really cool. It was just fun. We were really having a good time. And Yngwie showed up with his manager. Our old manager, who I didn't get along with anymore. And Yngwie came in, hey, man, how you doing? Said hello, got a hug, and everything's fine. And he went off and whatever. And then I turned around and looked about 20 minutes later, and he and Steven are falling, going onto the floor. And all I see is Steven doing this, and Yngwie's on the floor flopping around. Those guys are fighting on the floor, and then the bouncers come over and pick them up and get them separated, and then they threw Yngwie out. So they were going out the back door with Yngwie through the kitchen. So I ran after him, and I went out, and I said, Yngwie, what are you doing, man? And he went off on me. He was drunk. And so I grabbed him and kind of pushed him up against the freezers in the kitchen. I said, hey, whoa, calm down, man. It's Jimmy, you know, relax. So anyway, he and I had a little thing there, and then his manager was there, and I just went off on Andy. I just like, fuck you, buddy. You know, I mean, I don't know if you're supposed to curse on this thing or not, but
do whatever you want.
You can. We're past the 5 minute mark. We already made monetization. We're fine. Thank you.
I screamed at Andy and told him, get the fuck out of here. I was going to kill him. So anyway, they left. And that was that. Yngwie and I shook hands or something, and he left. Yngwie and I never stayed pissed off at each other. We had some problems in the band and all that, but it was always just like it come and go. We wrote songs together. We had fun together. Mm. So anyway, so Yngwie leaves. So about an hour later, the party's starting to break up. So Steven says to me, hey, you want to go to David Lee Roth's private club and on La Brea? So she, yeah, sure. We were drinking and we go to David, we go to this door and go up these long stairway, this dark warehouse kind of thing on La Brea, old store, whatever. And it's rocking. People are dancing and having a good time. And there's just trash cans full of beer. Wiedemann beer. I don't know if you probably don't know anything about that. Anyway, Wiedemann is an old beer, whatever. So, man, I love these old Wiedemanns. I'm nailing these Wiedemanns. I looked, there's Yngwie. There's a kind of a mosh pit dance floor kind of thing going on. Yngwie's on the other side. And I'm over here. Yngwie looks at me and starts screaming. And we start screaming at each other because we're both drunk. And we start screaming at each other. And I'm screaming, I'll fucking kill you. And he's like, fucking kill you and all this stuff. And
we've unleashed the fury. Sorry, couldn't help but throw that in there.
So it was just stupid. And then the bouncers made him leave. It was funny because I was just as bad as he was. They made him leave. And yeah, but he had said some stuff at the party before to Stephen that really pissed Stephen off, and Stephen went for it. Man, he was not having it. It was funny. It could have turned into something bad. If Yngwie and I would have gotten a hold of each other, that could have been bad because we were both drunk, and that would have been. Yeah. Oh man. That, yeah. So I'm glad we didn't because it was okay.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about the current version of Alcatraz. So you, there was an album called Poor and Innocent that you guys put out a couple of years ago with Graham Bonnet singing.
Great album.
Yeah. It is a great album.
Great. And the next thing I know is, sure.
The next thing I know it's Five and you've got a new singer. Is that right? Is it on Five that they got the new singer, Doogie White?
Yeah, Doogie White was on the next release.
Yeah. What really confused me is I thought that also Graham Bonnet had his own version of Alcatraz, but when I look at the credits to Born Innocent, you're on it, you know, and so what
Gary's on with, it as well as Joe Stump, who is a great addition.
Yeah, Joe Stump, who played. Oh, actually, I want to backtrack a little bit. The other day, I bought Parole Denied, which had another guitar player whose name I can't remember right now. Jeez, I should have wrote it down. A live album that you guys did in Japan. What made you revive the band, the name for the tour, you and Graham Bonnet at that time?
That was the Frontiers release.
Joey Taffola.
Yes. Thank you. Is that
from
his
Jack Panzer? Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. I couldn't remember his name. Thank you.
Frontiers released that when they promoted, they were promoting Graham in Europe. And then I think they did the special one night where Alcatraz, it was you, And Gary and Graham reunited with members of Graham's band, if I'm correct.
Well, the Graham Bonnet Band was going to Japan. We were the Graham Bonnet Band. And we were going to Japan. And then our manager said, hey, we should get Gary in on this and try to make a thing out of it. And Gary was way up for it. And the promoter in Japan loved the idea. So we took Gary to Japan. And that's what that was. Then the Graham Bonnet Band, we weren't drawing any, nobody was coming. I mean, the shows were pretty bad. It was just pitiful, in England or in the United States. So, we knew we had to do something. There's no point in going on like that. So we decided to change the name and get a guitar player that could play that stuff, so to speak. And that's what we did. And Joey had played in the Graham Bonnet Band. And then he left the Graham Bonnet Band. And that's when we decided, you know, we gotta do something different. We gotta do the Alcatraz. So we decided to do the Alcatraz thing. But that was just morphed from the Graham Bonnet Band into Alcatraz.
Alcatraz is the well-known brand and people know it. Yeah. I saw Graham, I think it was in 2010, and he played a show up in Northern Virginia, and it was billed as Graham Bonnet's Alcatraz, and it was Graham with Howie Simon on guitar, and he had the guy that plays drums now, Glenn Sobel, that plays for Alice Cooper.
Right.
And they just, you know, played. It was pretty much Grand Bonnet's greatest hit show. I mean, they played Alcatraz. They played Rainbow. They even did like Impella Terry and yeah. the Michael Schenker group stuff as well.
Right.
But that didn't seem to last. It seems like he did that little tour and then it just kind of didn't hear anything else for a while.
Just trying to make a buck.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to, some people suggested, well, why don't you get Jimmy back, you know, a keyboard player. They didn't want to use a keyboard player because it costs more money.
Yeah, he didn't have a keyboard player that night at all. No.
Some stuff on tape.
Yeah.
Yeah, but those songs don't work without a keyboard player. I mean, Jimmy, you left your imprint on those songs, you know? It's like you might as well take the drums out and make it just as hollow, you know? I mean, it's very rare where keyboards, you know, add that dimension to the songs. It's just, it wouldn't sound the same without it.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. Thank you very much. And you know, Yngwie and I put those songs together, and Yngwie never said, oh man, that's we can't do the keyboard thing there. That's too much keyboards. Yngwie was, yeah, that's cool. What would you play? I did the beginning for Krina Khouri. I was playing Krina Khouri, and he's like, yeah, that's cool. And I said, yeah, we just A minor, but go to the F and the bass. And he was all over it. He never, you know, so he embraced the keyboards.
Especially, he was a fan of Deep Purple and Rainbow. I mean, yeah. And that's just you guys were kind of a modern 80s version of that. You know,
yeah, that was the influence for sure. So, real natural thing. Yeah.
Well, Yngwie is a solo artist incorporates keyboards quite a bit. So never left him. But what? Yeah. So you guys do the Born Innocent album, which again I agree with Tony, freaking excellent album. Matter of fact, I bought it on a whim. I almost didn't buy it. And then I bought it because I'm a fan of Grand Bonnet and fan of yours, obviously. And I honestly didn't know Joe Stump from Adam. I didn't know who he was, you know.
Right.
And I bought it and I love the album. And then the next thing I know is, you know, do you guys have another album pretty quickly too? Five. And I didn't really want to like it because I'm a Grand Bonnet fan, but I did like it because I do like Doogie White.
Right.
Again, Doogie White sounds nothing like Grand Bonnet. I mean, it's just, it's like your guitar players, Yngwie, Steve Vai. What was he played with Alice Cooper, the Davy Johnston. Is that his name?
Danny Johnson. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I couldn't remember his. And then Joe Stump may be the closest to Yngwie, but he doesn't sound anything like Yngwie, really. He's got his own thing going.
Right, he does. Yeah.
Yeah, but these guys are all so different, yet it worked. So that's what amazes me about Alcatraz, but I don't know. So what happened with Grand Bonnet and the band with you guys?
I'm sorry?
What happened with Grand Bonnet and to change from Bonnet to Doogie White?
Graham didn't want to do heavy music. We were trying to write, and Graham's ideas were not heavy. They were not heavy, and we were trying to work something out, and it just wouldn't work. And the lineup thing at that point wasn't working, so it just made no sense. But and then Graham just said he didn't want to do this. He hated it and didn't want to do it. So great, that worked for everybody. But he quit. And then I love Doogie. I've always liked Doogie's voice, and I liked him as a person. I'd met him. We'd played in Scotland, and he came to the shows, and I love the guy. So it was a real natural thing for me. Anyway, I was just like, hey, let's work with Doogie, see how that goes. And it fit like a glove. So
I agree. He's actually he's got a warmer voice. I like his singing a lot. I discovered him in Rainbow, Strangers Than Us All, which I really like.
Oh,
but I was really, when you announced him as well, when I don't think I didn't even know if he was a singer. I just picked up the album and I bought it. And I really didn't. Again, I hate to tell you that, Jimmy. I really didn't want to like it because I'm such a Grand Bonnet fan. But I actually like it better than, and Graham, if you're listening, I'm sorry. I actually like it better than Born Innocent. I really, I do. And that's a lot for me to say, because Graham Bonnet is one of my favorite singers. He's done some material that I think, frankly, is shit, but he's so good that hey, I actually will still listen to it. Hey, I'm just being honest, dude.
Man.
You know? Hey, music is a subjective thing, Manny. Don't worry about it.
You know, the whole thing with Doogie as well, when I heard Doogie was the replacement for Graham, I think I accepted that because Doogie is kind of in the family.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like the Rainbow family, which kind of branches to Alcatraz, you know? I mean, and Doogie's been in so many problems. I mean, he's been in Ingbay. So he's kind of like the perfect guy to come in to replace Graham.
And he also sang with Schenker.
Yeah, and he has elements of Graham Bonnet in his voice. He has elements of David Coverdale. You know, he's got it just works. And he's such a great singer. I've been a fan of him for years. You know, he sings on there's a band, New Wave of British Metal band called Tank.
Yes.
He did albums with them.
Yes.
But I love Tank. I love old original Tank. But he did an album with them called War Nation, which is one of my favorite Tank albums.
Yeah, great record.
And on that album, he sounds a lot like Ronnie James Dio, because that album sounds like Black Sabbath the Humanizer to me.
Right.
He is just such an amazing singer. And he's a cool guy. I met him when he was touring with Yngwie.
Yeah, he's a really, really cool guy. And yeah,
very, very cool. I saw him with Rainbow when he, I think they toured in like 94 or 5. I saw him. I
don't remember, but
96 actually was when I saw him.
And people forget he auditioned for Maiden when Bruce left.
Yes, he did. He made it all the way up, I think, to the last round. He was the next in line.
But like I said, he fits so well on there. And I haven't purchased the album. I'm going to get it. I've only listened to a couple of the songs that I've heard online that you guys have released. And I'm definitely going to pick it up because I've got everything else by Alcatraz. I need to.
Well, I appreciate that.
Got to bookend it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've got all your stuff, even the live album you guys probably didn't want released, Born in Live in 83, which is really excellent, by the way.
Live Sentence.
There was another one that was released just a couple of years ago.
I picked that up too. It's like a triple live album and a white cover.
Yeah,
it's
freaking phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think Jimmy makes any royalties off any of these releases, guys. I think it's very unfair to him.
I don't know any of those.
So says a man wearing the bootleg shirt. Anyway.
This is all I can find.
I haven't listened to that one in a while, but I remember there was one point, this was the Live in Japan show, where you hear it sounds like Yngwie's guitar gets unplugged.
Yes.
And you don't hear guitar at all anymore. You hear something go, and it's like his guitar gets unplugged or goes out, and you hear Graham laughing. and it's not the same show from the video, evidently. So I mean, how many nights did you guys play when you guys filmed those shows, like in Japan? You guys probably did like multiple nights, didn't you?
Well, we did two shows in one day at Sun Plaza. Did an afternoon show and then we did a night show. And then we filmed, well, no, that was a different tour, sorry. We filmed, that was at Sun Plaza, I'm sure, where we filmed that video. So we'd done maybe four shows total, Osaka, Nagoya, and Tokyo. Two in Tokyo and then one in Osaka, one in Nagoya. I think that's all we did. And then we filmed in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm. You guys, and you guys were huge in Japan at that time.
Well, yeah, it was a shock to me. Because we got off the plane, and there are all these kids at the airport. You come out of the airport, it's like an American airport. You come out and, you know, customs, and you walk up that ramp and you look and there's all these people behind a railing waiting. The driver's got signs, and there's about 100 kids there.
Little free Jimmy Waldo dolls.
Well, I ain't shitting, man. It was, and so we come and we thought, wow, what is that? Oh, they put somebody up to that. You know, somebody paid for that. That's bullshit. And then it just, the whole tour was like that. And we got to the hotel in Tokyo, and there must have been 500 kids there. They wouldn't let them in the hotel. And we were down in the restaurant, which is down below street level, and you look up the windows, they just lined the windows, and some of them got in. So Yngwie and I go up to our room. We're going to go out. We're not done yet. We drank there, and then we're like, okay, now let's go out. So we go to the elevator, and a bunch of these girls had gotten in. So Yngwie and I go to the elevator, and there's nobody around. We walk in, and then just like cockroaches or something, they just came out of nowhere. And about eight girls crammed in that, little girls crammed in that elevator. And I was like, I'm looking around and going, no, I don't think so. So the elevator doors open. I said, see you later, Yngwie. And he grabs them all and goes down the hall to his room. He just took them as a herd. And I just was like, I'll see you in the lobby in an hour. You know,
he made his own geisha house.
Well, I don't know.
Hey, Jimmy, as a songwriter, when you wrote with Diggy White, you wrote for with his voice in mind. How was the songwriting different process with him versus Graham Bonnet?
You know what? It wasn't that different as far as an approach. I mean, I write just, I come up with something and I just, if I think it's good, then I go to Joe or whatever. And Joe writes what he writes. He wasn't really writing for Doogie. So there really was no difference. It just, those songs took on a different life with Doogie because Doogie wrote the melody and the lyrics and then had got involved in the arranging of the songs. So that's where the music would change a little, as Doogie would go, no, let's do it. Where Graham made like a double verse, you know, and Doogie was like, no, let's just a single, you know, whatever. There's different opinions about arranging, but as far as what comes out, Joe and I, we just write what we write. And whoever's singing, they got to sing it. They got to write over it and sing it.
Yeah. Gotcha. I don't know much about Joe Stomp. What's his background? How did he come into your orbit?
He's a Berkeley teacher. Yeah. That's his primary gig, but, I do know that he's had multiple solo releases. He was a guitarist in the band Holy Hell, which was released by Joey DeMaio of Manowar. Yep. And
he had Reign of Terror, the Reign of Terror band with Mike Becerra from Obsession.
And Yngwie. There you go. Adding more to
that. And Yngwie. Yeah.
But, you know, now he's killing it as a guitarist in Alcatraz. I have to admit, as a guitar player and as a fan, I was very excited because I said, well, this... You know, not that I thought he was going to be a duplicate of what Yngwie had already done, but I kind of felt that that was the style that best fit the music. And that's not taking anything away from Steve I or Danny Johnson.
Oh.
But, you know, Joe is just the perfect fit for you guys.
I think so. When we were looking at a bunch of different guitar players, and the guy we had at the time was not happening. So, Giles and I, the manager, Giles lives in Germany and I was living in LA, and Giles called me one night and he goes, we got to find a guitar player now. So I go, okay, let's do it. So we got on the internet together and we just scoured the internet. We looked at, I mean, everybody you could possibly, and we just check them off. We'd go, nah, that guy. And then we'd find a guy. We go, oh, that guy, he's good. Whoa, he might work. And then Giles would do a little research, go, now he's getting ready to do a tour with his band, or he's got a broken leg, or he quit music, whatever. You know, so we ended up, we narrowed it down to four or five guys, and we literally picked up the phone and called Joe and said, hey, would you like to? And Joe goes, yeah, that'd be fun. That sounds like fun. So why don't you come out and play with us? Let's see how it goes. So Joe flew to LA. And that's one of those things where he just walked in and we just played the songs. He knew those songs inside and out. So we played stuff off the first album. And it was like he'd always been there. And it sounded great. And he's the greatest guy. He's so much fun. He and I roomed together on the road. And we just have a blast. He's a great guy.
He was the perfect guy to come in and he could play the history as well, because he can play all that stuff.
Yeah, he knows how to play. I mean, he can play that stuff. The speed was not a problem, but the he gets it. He loves Yngwie, and he understands what it needs to be. So, yeah, he was the perfect guy. It worked. We auditioned a couple other guys that could play that stuff, but they were super, super clean, very reserved, very careful. And it was, well, we might as well just play a tape. Let me get the passes and we'll just play a tape. There was no point. They had no vibe at all. They just played the stuff. And it was impressive to hear somebody play those songs note for note. And but I know a few people that can. And that's not the end of it, though, because if you don't play it with – Yngwie plays with fire. He's the lightest guitar player I've ever worked with as far as picking. He plays with this intensity. You know, he's just and that's what Joe does. Joe's a very aggressive player. And I love that.
Where does Joe live?
Boston.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, because he teaches at Berkeley, so he lives about 10 minutes from Berkeley or something.
I wanted to ask, because we were talking about how the band came together. We didn't mention. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Is it Jan or Jan Yvena?
Jan Yvena.
And he came from Alice Cooper's band. There, Manny, that was for you. Do you still keep in touch with him? I'm sorry. If you answer the first question first, do you still keep in touch with him?
Where did Jan come from? You mean besides?
No. I mean, do you still keep in touch with Jan?
Yes. Yeah. Not much, but we've talked. We're still friends, and we did a project together. Actually, he played on a thing that I did. Oh boy, about 15 years ago, called Ashdown, which didn't do anything. But I talked to Jan. Yeah, I talked to him maybe 3-4-6 months ago, maybe something like that.
Yeah, because I think his drumming was great, especially, you know, with the first two albums. I mean, you know, when I think of his for all intents and purposes, his double bass shuffle beat on Too Young to Die, it's just, you know, I really didn't hear. But then again, I was a kid when I first heard it, so that was my first exposure to anything like that. And I thought it was incredible. But I got to ask, when you recorded the album, I know that at the time, the same year, Def Leppard's Pyromania came out, and the drums on that album was a Fairlight CEI. It was a drum machine.
Right.
And that was the way that the drums sounded on that record. How was it that they were recorded? Because they I want to say almost like a very interesting reverb type sound, especially on the snare.
Well, in my opinion, that record didn't sound good. I didn't like the way that record sounded at all. None of us did. The producer did a horrible job. And we started off, he had Jan play some Simmons drums, which were electronic kit in the day. And they sounded terrible. We cut a couple of songs and we were like, no way, no way. So we went back to using real drums. But he just, the way he EQ'd things and stuff, I did not like the drum sound. Did not like it at all. None of us liked the way the record sounded.
I understand. But at least know that it was a huge improvement on Disturbing the Peace. I mean, you know, you hear those drums on songs like Skyfire and Stripper. Yeah, yeah. It's just wow, you know.
Yeah.
Some of the best playing that I ever heard. I have a couple of other questions, but
Dan is a great drummer, and that record was a lot. That was a real record. We did that with Eddie Kramer, and Eddie Kramer's a live guy. Eddie doesn't want no tricks, so we rehearsed the shit out of those songs before we ever went in the studio. So we went in the studio and we just played. I mean, that record was cut almost live because we knew the songs so well and we played them so much.
And yeah, it's
used to rehearsing like that with Zappa. So we did that. So that that's why it came out the way it did. It feels good. You know, we played to a click for most of those songs, but it feels really good. Jan was a master at that. And the drum sound, Eddie Kramer gets a fantastic drum sound. So Eddie nailed it. And Eddie pushed us at rehearsals, pre-production rehearsals. Eddie was like never satisfied. So always pushing, you know, you can play that better. Let's shorten the verse. Let's lengthen the chorus. Or no, that drum fill you're doing going into the chorus doesn't work. And we argued with Eddie, and you know, and then, but at the end of the day, it came out great. So,
yeah, it sounds like an incredibly tight unit on that album.
Were live, the band was great. With Steve, well rehearsed, and very focused and well rehearsed.
I mean, the hardest thing I think that I've learned from this conversation is that Graham hated the heavy music, because I'm just like, wait a minute. You were in Rainbow. You were in Michael Schenker Group. You were in Alcatraz. You were in Impellitteri. You were in Blackthorn. You were in Anthem for one album, doing an entire English album of Japanese metal songs. Where the heck do you get off saying you don't like this music when that's what you're best known for?
I don't know. He said it for a long time. And it really came to a head with us where he was just not happy at all and wanted to leave the band. So that's what he did.
One other question I want to ask is your keyboard. Do you use the same brand keyboards today that you did then, or have they changed somewhat? I mean, not that I'm expecting you to, you know, no. I know Kurzweil was very popular back in the day, but I don't even think you used those, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I did not. The first keyboards I had were just a Hammond B3, which is right there. Same one. Hammond B3 and Leslie, which is right there. Same one. A Mellotron, which is in my garage. A Mini Moog. And those are the basic instruments. I think that first album, I used Rhodes Chroma, which is a kind of a, it's hard to explain. It was built by ARP, but later sold to CBS, so it took on the Rhodes name as you know. Anyway, but basically, now everything I do is software. So I use the same instruments, they're all just software. And they sound exactly like the hardware. People argue with me on the road. We play, and people go, you know, man, I was hoping you'd have the Mini Moog and the B3. And I said, yeah, well, if you got $2,000 to fly it to England and carry it around and rent a van, sure. And if you rent, a friend of mine toured England for 3 weeks, and they rented a B3 and a Leslie. Cost them $3,000. We can't afford it. So I do everything in a program called Mainstage, which is you can use anything you want, anything. And I have Mellotrons. I have every Mellotron sound that was ever done. And I have Mini Moogs. I have three different companies, Mini Moogs, and I have everything. So when I build the set for live, I can just pick from anything I want. Can never, and this all travels with me. So it's just a laptop.
I mean, who was a bigger influence on you with the keyboards?
In the beginning, I got into the really heavy distorted stuff. Was the Soft Machine, Mike Rutledge. You familiar with the Soft Machine at all?
Alan Holdsworth, right?
At one point, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were kind of I didn't like their songs as much as I liked, just they were players. And this is 1969. And we were listening to that, and I was just blown away. This guy was using this Lowry organ through an amp. And I talked to people that knew them. They said the reason he used that organ through an amp is because he couldn't afford a Hammond. And he couldn't afford a Leslie. So they just had to make it. So that was my biggest, big influence on me. And then Vincent Crane from Atomic Rooster.
Great stuff. Yeah.
And Rod Argent blew me away. And of course, Keith Emerson. I wasn't so much into the classical thing that Emerson did, but his playing just took my head off. I can't play like that, but I love him. He was an influence. John Lord was a huge influence on me. I just love that Hammond through a Marshall, which I have two Marshalls here, and I Marshall cabinets, and I use that on the record. I use the B3 through a Marshall on the record. No Leslie sometimes.
Just wanted to piggyback real quick on what you're talking about before about the whole overhead thing. And that's what a lot of people seem to fail to understand. I mean, like Wayne and I record music together as well. And, you know, we record from the studios in our home until we find the sound that we want. We're ready to say, okay, we record, and then we send them to our singer who mixes it. So, you know, people ask us, you know, how much did you pay to do this? And we said, oh, not a lot. And they said, oh, well, don't you think it would have sounded better in a bigger studio? And I'm like, well, sure, if you could afford it. You know, it's like, you know, who is anyone to say what a musician should do to be able to save money to continue doing what they love? You know, I mean, it's like overhead is something that you need to take into account, because it's not the 80s where there's money to burn anymore. It's a completely different world.
There is just all basically no money or low money.
No record labels.
The drums on Born Innocent, I cut those in a garage with about 10 microphones and a Behringer digital board with 18 inputs. And that's it. No album.
That sounds killer.
No console, nothing. I did the same thing on V and the same thing on this record. I went to Italy to record the drums because our drummer lives in Italy. He's from the UK, but he lives in Italy. So I took it. We were in Scotland doing vocals with Doogie. And then I took a plane to Italy and spent 10 days at our drummer's house recording drums in a room. So the note studios, forget that.
Mm. Yeah. I think that's a thing of the past. Well, I'm going to take off, but I wanted to thank you personally. They're staying on, but for your time, I've been a fan of Alcatraz since I was 13. I even now like Dangerous Games, which I did not like at the time, but now I like it.
Yeah, so, well, but I appreciate that. It's not my favorite Alcatraz record. There's some things about it that I like. And the producer of that record, Richie Podler, God rest him, was a genius. That guy, musically, I've worked with two people in my life that I would seriously say, you know, people throw that genius word around. Oh, he's a genius. He's a genius. But Richie was a genius, and Todd Rundgren. Todd Rundgren is, you would never know it to just hang out with the guy, but oh my God, he's one of the most musical people I've ever met.
Well, Eddie Kramer worked with my hero, Jimi Hendrix. So that's, Eddie, if that's the only thing he ever did, that would be enough. But anyway, yeah.
Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin, that little band. Who? Yeah.
Well, yes. Nobody's heard it.
Yeah.
Real quick, and I'll let you go. Funny Eddie, well, it's not Eddie Kramer's story, but John Paul Jones and Robert Plant and Jimmy Page were on David Letterman. And Letterman's talking to him, and they're kind of quiet guys. They're not, you know, real loud. You know, they would answer the questions and stuff. And Letterman looked at John Paul Jones, and he goes, so what other bands do you listen to? And John Paul Jones went, there's other bands.
I remember that. Yeah.
Fucking crazy. People just drop dead. And he's so quiet. And he's a quiet guy, very polite, gentlemanly guy. And he goes, there are other bands.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah. He's funny dude.
Yeah,
always loved him in the movie where he's like, tour dates. You know, I remember in the Song Remains the Same movie.
Oh, yeah.
Going to their houses. And
I'll tell you a Stephen Rosen, John Paul Jones story. Stephen toured with Zeppelin. He was on the plane with him. And as a journalist, they took him on the plane. And he had written something, and it was misunderstood by John Paul Jones. So Stephen was sitting there, and he said he felt this on his shoulder, and it was John Paul Jones wanted to kick his ass because he had said about the band or about Jimmy Page, and he didn't. It was just taken out of context or something, because Stephen worshipped those guys, and he worshipped Jimmy Page. So, but it's funny because John Paul Jones, he goes, well, if I was going to get the shit beat out of me, how cool would that be to have John Paul Jones get out of me, you know.
The story.
Probably say, hope that didn't hurt. Great
story.
Have you seen the photo? Have you seen the photo of the fan with the Led Zeppelin shirt passed out at a concert, and John Paul Jones is standing next to him, did a selfie with him? That is great.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again. I have to go get my kid, but thank you. It was nice meeting you. And
great to meet you.
I really enjoyed the newest album. And if I didn't ask these guys, I wouldn't have said anything. So I did like it. It was really
appreciate
good.
That very
and I have, look forward to more Alcatraz music. So
we're writing as I speak. I just said three. Well, anyway, we're writing. Yeah.
Any tour plans?
I'm going to Boston.
Any tour plans for the band?
Well, we're going to England in February. And in Europe, right after England for about a week. And then if things go well, we'll be touring the States in March, I think it is, late March. So a bunch of dates here. So if everything goes okay, knock on wood, then we'll be touring here.
Hopefully you'll have some East Coast dates and I can see you.
Yeah, well, if you guys come to New York, I'd love that.
And I can get you to sign my Alcatraz poster.
Yeah. God.
Quick question about this. Were you guys endorsed by Area Pro 2 guitars at the time?
Yeah.
I've never seen Yngwie with an Area.
We were so drunk during that photo session, I can't even begin to tell you.
I couldn't tell.
We were having fun.
There is one question I want to ask about the Rock Palace, though. Was Howie Mandel as big a germaphobe then as he is now? Like, were you able to shake hands with him?
No, I don't even remember him. I mean, I remember him being there and doing that, but I don't even know if I actually shook hands with him. I honestly don't.
Most likely not.
Just another gig for us. We didn't really know what it was. For us, it was just like, here's where we're playing tonight. And it's a TV show, though. You're only going to do three or four songs. We're like, okay. So
you guys performed live on there, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, that was live. Yeah.
Because I've seen some clips. I remember when Dio was live, but when Black Sabbath played with Ian Gillan, they lip synced.
Yeah, because you can't fade out live.
Yeah.
But I knew I could tell you how I knew Alcatraz was live, because on the record, they're playing an E standard live. On that show, they played an E flat standard. So they were down a half step. Yes.
Oh,
I'm a geek.
He's
Jimmy.
A nerd.
look behind me. I'm a geek.
Gosh. I don't remember.
See his black curtains, man.
No, I got the guitars behind me.
I see them now. Yeah.
But I knew you guys had a band. Steven told me he had a band. He said it was really good.
Oh, all right.
I'd like to hear it.
We didn't pay him to say that, but that's cool.
Colin Madden is asking, is there any dates for down south?
Pardon?
Is there any dates for down south? Is there something wrong with my mic? It's not loud today.
No, it's you, Wayne.
Okay.
I have Marshall Cymbal Syndrome.
Ah, okay.
Lamps in your head for and cymbals.
I get it, yeah. Yes. Any dates for down south?
Let's see. Nashville, New Orleans, Houston. If I remember, that's what I saw on the. Yeah, that's all it was. But this tour that got bumped because of the visa problem, there was several down south.
So are you guys going to go back out with Girls School again?
Yes.
Because I know they're coming over. They're playing the Hell's Heroes Fest in Houston in March, I believe.
Yes.
That's probably one of the dates off or something.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I got the little itinerary and it said, and you ain't playing. So, yeah.
Jeez.
No, I love them. They are the coolest people, and we get along so well. It's a really good matchup on the road. It works really well.
Yeah.
And they're great people. So it'll be us and Lillian Axe.
Oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah.
Saw those guys a couple years ago. They were really good.
Yeah, the good band. Really good band.
Yeah, I definitely love Girl School. Jackie Chambers married me. Who said that? Who said that? Sorry. Yeah. Oh, such gorgeous woman. The great guitar player.
And they are the nicest people, I can't tell you. Just hanging out with them. We played in, we were in France, and we needed to do, somebody came up with the idea of them doing some background vocals on one of the songs on Take No Prisoners. It was our first video. It's an animated video. Don't Get Mad, Get Even. And so they said, yeah, we'd love to sing the chorus. So I carried my rig with me. So I set up in the hotel room, and they came over. I handed them a Shure 58 and played the track to a little speaker like this so they could hear it. And they did the background vocals for that.
Oh, cool.
Really cool. Really cool.
Awesome.
Before Manny left, he mentioned the new album, Take No Prisoners. Talk a little bit about that. I was actually listening to it today, and it's really, really good. I really enjoyed it a lot. So talk about how that kind of differs from like the previous album.
Yeah, we spent more time on this. Well, we had a lot of songs. As usual, bands, you know, we're in a situation, the record company said, man, we need a record now, you know, as soon as possible. So we were under some pressure to get that record done. This one, we weren't. And we write some on the road. And I can record stuff on the road. So we recorded demos in England and dressing rooms and different places. So Take No Prisoners, we had longer to live with the songs. Mm. We had about 15 or 18 songs that were just, we were there all the time, you know, and I had them and I would go back and listen and then some of them, we loved the songs, but we just had too much of that. We couldn't have too many of that tempo. So somebody had to go. So we had the luxury to weed them down from 15 or 18 songs, you know. So that record took about, I don't know, 6 months to write and record with all of us living in other countries and shit.
I mean, you can do that now. You can all do your parts wherever you're at.
Yeah.
I mean, so much easier. The drums, then I go to Boston and I record Joe at his house, but the 100 watt Marshalls, it's fucking loud. And then I come home and do keyboards.
Do you like the way like you're able to like do all this stuff kind of like on your own and at home and stuff like that? Or do you miss going to the studio and, you know, getting the studio sounds?
In a perfect world, if we had money, I would say everybody leave your cell phones at home. We're going to a studio. And I would probably go to England and get a really nice studio with really nice accommodations and a rehearsal place. And rehearse and write the songs in rehearsal, or come in with ideas and flush them out at rehearsal and lock in on the grooves and the tempos and all that stuff, and then go in the next room and record. In a perfect world, that's the way I like the way we made Disturbing the Peace, the way we made No Parole was damn near live. We all set up in a really small room and just played. And a lot of that we used. So
just human contact on the spot and getting people's ideas.
There is nothing, you can't replace that. I don't care what anybody says. You know, you can't. There's some great records made this way, and that's fine, but that's a different thing.
Yeah.
And I would love to do that, but it's expensive.
It is expensive. But like I said before, even the new album sounds really good. Even the way you record and everything, you can't really tell it's like not done in a big, huge studio. It sounds really, really good.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. You have no idea. Yeah. I really do.
Yeah, it's really good. Anybody else have anything? Because Jimmy, you've been here for a long time, and I don't want to keep you all night, although we can talk to you for hours.
I'm enjoying
it. It's been great. I was going to say I got to take off, but yeah, it's been great. And you've told some great stories as well. It's good to hear stuff like that. I always love to hear behind the scenes stuff.
Well, we'd be here all night. I mean, I could tell you stories that your hair would stand up, and then, you know, now I could just go on forever.
Well, you're always welcome to come back, Jimmy. We'd love to have you. And you know, if anybody else in the band would love to come back, would love to come on, like Gary or Joe or Doogie, I mean, we'd love to have him as well. I mean, we're all fans, so
I mean, they would absolutely. So I'll mention it. I'll absolutely tell them they should do this.
Very cool. And I actually personally wanted to give you this message. So this is the copy of the album that Wayne and I did. Our band's name is Severed Angel. Uh-huh. There's an added bonus track on here called A Fate Worse Than Death, which was a riff that I wrote. And I just wanted to personally thank you, because if it wasn't for Alcatraz's No Parole for Rock and Roll affecting and warping my 4-year-old little kid self, I would have never have written a song like that. So I wanted to personally thank you for the inspiration.
I can't tell you, that means a lot to me. I mean, you know, I really appreciate that very much. And that's so cool. Wow. I've never had anybody say that ever.
Well, I'm one of a kind, custom made, not for sale.
You don't find too many 4-year-olds that go, hey.
Well, I yelled at my brother, so imagine my voice about 5 notches higher.
And Lou, you can send him a copy of that CD. So
I would love to, sure. If Jimmy, if you'd wait after the show gets off the air, I'll send you a copy too. I still have to send Steve's.
Oh, geez. Maybe Lou's not the best one to send CDs.
No. I'm going to the post office tomorrow to get it done.
All right, Jimmy.
I have one, seriously.
All right, very cool. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. Where thanks can people lot, go man. and get the new Alcatraz album?
I'm told the best place to get that is Amazon.
Amazon, yeah, that's where everybody gets all this stuff from.
So. There are record stores. Somebody told me they still have record stores. It's actually
they do. Yeah,
and they did vinyl of this record, so there's a lot of vinyl. But everybody says, anybody ask you, just tell them Amazon. So,
there's a good independent seller on that sells on eBay that I buy a lot from, the original Heavy Metal Museum. Yes. A guy named Gary Schaefer. He has the new Alcatraz. He has all the new stuff.
Oh wow!
Comes out. Yeah. So the original Heavy Metal Museum.
There could be a lot of those people out there, because you just buy them wholesale from the label, and anybody can sell them. Yeah. So I'm told. I don't go on and look at it or look for it or anything. I'm kind of weird. I don't do Facebook or I don't Google my. I never Google myself. I don't want to know about what's.
Oh, I found a lot of stuff about you.
I'm just curious, whose collection's bigger, Tony's or Wayne's at this?
Oh, Tony! Every time we do a show on Thursdays, he's grabbing things out that I'd never even seen before. So
this is just one room.
He's insane. This just looks big. That's his whole house.
Just one room. It sounds impressive until you find out he just has one room.
Yeah, his wife's on the other side holding up the wall of CDs.
Tony,
so where are you from?
I'm from New York, and Lou's from New York too.
Yes, sir.
And
I'm in Tony. I'm in North Carolina.
Okay, whereabouts?
Near Raleigh.
Okay,
actually, I'm in Rocky Mount, which is like near maybe 45 minutes from Raleigh.
Exactly. I played. I used to live in Wilmington.
Oh wow! Yeah, cool. Okay.
So my brother lives in Raleigh for years and years and years. I go to Raleigh. I've been playing there since the 60s. So I know North Carolina well.
Cool. Cool.
Very cool.
All right, let me know the next time you're coming. You're not on Facebook, but somehow or another, get up with me. Let me know.
Message me and I'll tell.
Well, go ahead. You have to have a beer and you can tell me more road stories.
I'd be glad to. It's fun. It's fun. Yeah,
Wayne, I just want to drop one message. This Friday is Bandcamp Friday. So if you want to buy a copy of the album, just go to severedangel.com. And there's a link on the homepage that will take you directly to the Bandcamp page. And Wayne, what separates Bandcamp Fridays from other Fridays?
There's no fees.
There's no fees.
There's no fees.
No fees. So get one.
We get all the money.
Cool.
But we're sending Jimmy his own copy because he's awesome. Screw you.
Right. Yeah. Seriously.
All right, guys, I gotta go, but right. Have a good night.
Right, take care, Tony.
Everybody, please hit subscribe on our YouTube channel. Go to redsidereview.com, find out all of our other shows and everything else that we have, and we will see you guys next week. Again, thank you very much, Jimmy.
Bye. Jimmy, Stand by because I got to get your address. Demone.
I will. I'm here. I ain't going anywhere.
Cool.
Well, we are. Goodbye.
Nighty. Bye.